Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. My name is Patrick James Lynch and you are listening to another Bloodstream Mini.
So understanding pain is a very difficult topic with so many different aspects that go into it.
That voice belongs to Connie R. Faltinick, a biochemist and author of the new book, Pain, Why Do We Continue to Suffer? The Culture and Science of Pain. She is my interview guest today on this Bloodstream Mini, coming up in just a moment after I tell you that this episode, as all episodes of the Bloodstream Podcast, was made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. To learn more about Takeda and the resources that they have made available to the bleeding disorders community, as well as their response to COVID-19, visit bleedingdisorders.com. And now let me tell you a little bit about Connie. Connie R. Faltinick obtained her PhD in biochemistry from Albany Medical College of Union University in Albany, New York. Following postdoctoral training, she worked at the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland, and then entered the pharmaceutical industry as a research scientist. Over her career, she published more than 100 scientific articles. Prior to her retirement, she was Senior Director of Neuroscience and Pain Research at Abbott Laboratories, where she directed research to discover novel, non-opioid medications for pain relief. And with that, let's talk to Connie. So thank you for joining me. Pain is a subject of interest to me personally, and at Believe Limited and Bloodstream, we've been doing a lot of work around pain. I just mentioned in the introduction you have your new book, Pain, Why Do We Continue to Suffer? The Culture and Science of Pain, which I do want to talk about. But before we get into the book itself, tell me a little bit about yourself. Is this your first major piece on pain? A little bit more on your background and when pain became something of interest to you?
Sure. My background, I'm a scientist. I have a PhD in biochemistry. And I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for most of my career. And a large portion of that was to try to identify, discover new pain medications that were as effective as the opioids, but didn't have their significant liabilities. So it was really focused on trying to develop new pain meds that would help a variety of people. And I worked on that for several years. And so part of my book talks about some of my experiences in trying to discover new pain meds. I also talk about the existing meds, their pros and cons. But pain is much more than just a medical problem. It also has a wide-ranging emotional component. And so understanding pain is a very difficult topic with so many different aspects that go into it. So I was interested in exploring why did it become such a complicated story outside of just the science, which I knew, but I was interested in learning, why is it so complicated? Are there other aspects of our history, our culture that influence how we look at pain and whether pain can be treated? So I want to bring both of those things together into a single book, because I think that pain is both a medical, scientific, as well as a cultural issue. So I wanted to, and then also wanted to bring in some of the later research saying that, maybe there is hope for the future.
So I'm sure this is explored on a deep level in the book, but from an overview point of view, what would you say chiefly is the difference between the culture and the science of pain?
Yeah, the science is basically pain is pretty far behind. It's behind a lot of other diseases, like high blood pressure, which can be well controlled. There's many different medicines.
Why do you think that is?
It's the complexity. It is a complexity. I mean, blood pressure is regulated very tightly, but there are only a few regulators, so where to go.
Okay.
Whereas pain, it starts, when you have an accident, hit your finger or something, whatever. But then the signal has to get transmitted all the way up into the brain. And only when it gets transmitted into the brain do you feel pain. Well, you can imagine when you get something into the brain, you've got other things going on in your brain too. So all the emotions and thoughts and beliefs play a role within it. So it's much more complicated than a lot of other diseases. I always give the example of diabetes, which is pretty well understood, and hypertension, which is very well understood, but pain we're still kind of learning. And then the role of culture, we're all the product of our upbringing, our families, our heritage, what we've been taught. And throughout history, there have been many ideas about what pain is. And I don't mean from a scientific perspective, but I mean from the cultural perspective. In terms of, is pain something that we should just ignore? Is pain something that if we try to not think about it, use other psychological ways to dampen the thought about pain, will that be sufficient to help? Is pain something, if one is religious, especially the Christian religion, that pain often is considered to be a punishment, you've done something wrong, or that you go back to the Bible in terms of Adam and Eve and the initial fall from grace that resulted in pain. And it's not just religious, it's also the ancient Greeks thought that they had different opinions about pain, but all these kinds of things feed into our modern thoughts. And for example, the Christian church, especially the Catholic church, has not really accepted new ways to manage pain very eagerly. When
shocking.
Anesthesia was first
I
developed.
I say as a Reformed Catholic.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and when anesthesia was first developed, there were a lot of people who said, no, you should not use it. Pain was God-given. And therefore, you should not disturb anything that is God-given. And this was even like with childbirth or surgeries, that there was real reluctance especially in the 1800s, early 1900s, when some methods were being developed to control pain, but people didn't want to use them. So there's culture that is in there that definitely, it still influences people. There are still people who say that, I guess I got the sickness or I got this pain because I'm a bad person. And then there's biases also in terms of if there's pain relief that's used, who should get it? There's often reluctance to treat very young children, especially neonates, that it was way into the middle of the 20th century that there were examples of neonates that were undergoing very intense surgeries and they had no anesthesia. And this is true. Obviously, it's not the case now. It's not that long ago. But still, there is this concern that, maybe anesthesia or pain meds or whatever should not be used that frequently, and that some pain is simply meant to be endured.
So that's interesting. The cultural and scientific components of pain exist on two different tracks. So staying on the cultural track for a moment, as you're describing scenarios in the past where maybe it was more ubiquitously adopted that pain was something from God, I feel as though as communication has improved over the decades and the centuries, and we are more connected and have more access to information and ability to share ideas, I would imagine that there's been a movement toward more cultural acceptance of pain. But again, putting the science part aside, would you agree with that? Have we been moving in a more culturally accepted or has pain become more culturally accepted over time? And if so, do you think, what do you attribute that to?
Yes, I think it's, especially in the latter half of the 20th century, I think there was a big push to understand and to that pain can be relieved. And there was a big push in hospitals and doctors that if someone's in pain, we're going to do everything we can to relieve the pain. And that was good in many ways. I mean, it was the development of the hospice movement. It was the development of palliative care. Physicians at one point in time, in the latter part of the 20th century, early 21st century, they were supposed to ask their patients about whether they were in pain. And this was supposed to be what they ask when they check blood pressure, they check heart rate, they check respiration rate. This was considered to be one of the vital signs. So there was a big push that yes, pain should be controlled and that it's not something that people should have to suffer. However, there's a big however here. And that, however, is that this led to a large increase in the use of opioids. And of course, we all know that opioids cause serious health problems, social problems. And so there was a move to stop prescribing opioids. There are many patients today who have been successfully treated with opioids for many years, low doses, they're doing fine on it, they are not addicted, they need this medicine to keep them in a reasonably pain-free condition. But now it's become very, very difficult for patients to actually get their opioids. There's more and more restrictions, many more restrictions that are going into the prescribing of opioids. So there's many, many cases of patients who are crying that they need their meds, not because they're addicted, but because they're in severe pain and the opioids are the only thing that can help them. But because there are so many issues with opioid abuse, it's become really hard to get the medications, and now pain is even being devalued. That there are many physicians who don't trust patients when the patients say they're in pain. They think that they are simply drug seeking. They won't even give strong medications for pain. Many, many physicians have dropped their pain patients. And this leads to people who then become desperate, not because they're addicted, but because they are in severe pain and they need their medication. So some of them then do turn to the drugs on the street.
Sure, of course.
Which, of course, is a huge problem.
But if that's all that's available, as you're describing, it makes perfect sense. Was there anything that you learned over the course of working on the book that was unexpected, particularly surprising, or changed the course of your research and writing?
Yes. as I say, I'm a biochemist. I work to develop medications for most of my career. And so I was very geared towards pharmacological approaches to pain. That's what I worked on. But I realized that there is a large group of people who do not want to take medications and that they are looking at the alternative approaches. Now, I studied that quite a bit because it wasn't something I knew much about. And what I learned with them is that many of them do work for selected patients with certain types of pain. They're not magic bullets for most people, but they have a small effect in many patients. But what I found interesting was pulling it back into the science part was that some of these alternative methods, we now have some understanding of how they actually might work. It's when I can find a biochemical mechanism that can explain how these alternative methods would help relieve pain, then I became very interested. So it pulled me back into my comfort zone, even though I started with the alternatives as, I don't know much about it, I'm not so sure. But now I've come to think that, no, these do serve a purpose. And the more we understand about how they work, the better we can improve them. So I'm not saying they are the be-all, end-all, but I think that they are complementary, at least, to the medications.
That makes logical sense. And credit to you for making that discovery and being able to kind of, as you said, come back to home, come back to your specialty and apply this new perspective and these new learnings. That sounds very productive.
It was fun.
Have you had personal experiences with chronic pain that have driven your passion for this work?
No. It was my profession, working on new medications. But I do have, not personal, but familial experience. My mother suffered from chronic depression for her whole life. And so I see in some ways there's a lot of overlap in some of the issues with pain and depression. So that kind of got me interested in part with buck up kind of attitude that, you know, it's your fault that you're depressed, you know, you did something wrong, you're sinned, da 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 da. And so,
right, and it gets coated
in
shame.
It's coated in shame, and there still is the shame of being in pain. It's people sometimes, they don't want to admit they're in pain. They think it's shameful.
Staying on the subject of your time working in the pharmaceutical industry as a biochemist, what did you enjoy most about that? What kept that career path interesting to you over the course of your career?
You know, I'm very driven to do something useful. And I find that there is a large unmet medical need for better pain management. It's clear that many, many people are suffering. And so I hope that I could have some sort of impact upon developing some new kind of treatment for pain. But it wasn't just totally the biochemistry part of it. What I also, as I got further advanced in my career, I really enjoyed the whole aspects of pharmacology and how medications are discovered, how they're optimized, how they're brought to the market. So it was a career path that opened up a lot of new avenues as I became responsible for coordinating all the different aspects of trying to bring a new medication to the market. So it was stimulating work. It was fun work, pulling little pieces together and trying to find a picture that is composed of all these different aspects is what I like in science.
And when was the moment then that you knew your research in pain was going to be leading toward this book? And a follow-up to that, I'd be curious, the book's been out for less than a month at the time we're recording this. May 10th, it first came out. Is there any feedback that you have received in the first few weeks that has resonated with you or been particularly surprising or unexpected?
No, not yet. We've sent out feelers, you know, to different people. I have a couple friends who read it, but, you know, friends are a little bit biased sometimes. They're writing reviews. I haven't seen them yet.
So when was the moment in your career where you thought, I think this research is leading me toward a book?
You know, I didn't start it until after I retired. It was really after I retired and I'd been, you know, running 90 miles an hour, you know, 24/7 kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I can't just shut down my brain. I have to do something. So, you know, I thought, well, maybe there's a book here. And I started, you know, reading not just the science literature about pain, but anything I could get my hands on that talked about pain. Not so much personal experiences, but, you know, how other people looked at pain, the history of pain. I read many, many books about the history of pain because I wanted to know, you know, how did people used to look at it? And then I just came to the idea that it's both the history, our culture, as well as the science that results in the poor pain management that we actually have. And then I thought by pointing out that both of them, and they do come together in you know, in some ways, in terms of that the culture could prevent people from using the medications or alternative methods.
Did you find voices that shared your point of view? Are there other people either in biochemistry or pain medicine specialists or other pain-oriented professionals who share or appreciate the way in which you have understood and contextualized pain in this book as both something of scientific and cultural consideration?
You know, people are very divided in what they study. You know, pain researchers study pain. They don't think about culture. Historians have written, there's a lot of good history books who have talked about, you know, the history, the culture of pain. But I did not find anybody who was trying to pull them together and say that, hey, guys, you know, it's both of these that contribute to the problem. The only person I can think of who approached it, although she approached it from a journalistic point of view, was Judy Foreman. She's a journalist. And she wrote a book talking about the science and talking about the problem of pain, but not so much about the history. You know, she talked about the demographics and about the need.
So it kind of dips a toe into that broader perspective that you explored more fully. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. That makes sense. What would you say so a lot of people listening to this would fall into the patient, caregiver, family member category as opposed to the professional category. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, what would you say is the most valuable lesson in the book for patients and loved ones who have people affected by chronic pain?
Well, I think it's worthwhile for people to understand the medications that are out there and the pros and cons, because I don't think there is a very good understanding of that. And then to also look at the alternative methods in concert with looking at the medications and see the pros and cons. Most of the alternative methods have not been as well explored. Most of the reviewers will say they give a modest effect, but not too much for very severe pain for the alternative methods. But I think for people to have a better understanding of how medicines that we currently have actually do work, how good are they, what are their side effects. So, and then also the alternative methods to keep in mind some of the, there are some new ones that are coming out that I think people should, if they do have chronic pain, that they should be following these. And so I tried to point them out that there are some.
Anything in particular?
Well, there's one that I find very interesting that a friend of mine actually is using it. And it's a method where you have to have a small surgery. It's not a big one, but they have to put some electrodes into your spine. And then you put a generator just under the skin, probably in the buttocks. And then you have a receiver. And so you can activate this gizmo to essentially block out the pain signal.
Wow.
It's she says it really works. There are some initial side effects at first. There's some tingling sensations that seem to go away with time. She didn't find it that disturbing, but I guess some people don't like it. So, you know, nothing's perfect. But this is something that, you know, may have some more extended value going forward. I don't know if it's covered by insurance. I don't know. There's also another little device. This one doesn't require surgery. It's called Quell, Q-U-E-L-L. And you just put it on the site of pain, where you have pain. So you have your pain in your leg. And so you put this device on there, and what it does is it sends out signals to the nerves, but it basically scrambles the signals that are coming from the pain source. So now you don't feel the pain. Now
that reminds me of, isn't there like a household thing you can do for mice where it just confuses them and sends them off to some other direction?
Oh, yeah, there are such things. Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like the pain version of that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Let me just see if I get it right here. I think it's so many different ones here that I cover quite a few different ones here. Some are not as well developed as others. Not quite. It was approved in 2014.
These are listed in the book?
Yeah, it's in the book. It was approved in 2014, and it was reported to decrease pain 81% in patients with chronic low back and lower extremity pain.
Okay, that's a big number. 81% is a significant number.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is you can just wear it on your leg. And it's, it sets out electrical stimulation. It's called a transcutaneous electrical stimulator.
It's a mouthful.
And it's small. It's been around for a while, but it's previously it was pretty big and, didn't get much
Makes
use.
Sense.
But now it's been reduced to something else. And then there's this other, the scrambling one, this other one. It's something called Calmar. And it also, you don't have to have surgery for it. It's just some pads that you put around the painful area, and then you activate it with some device. And it scrambles the pain signals. Now, I don't know, how many studies have been done on that. It's relatively new. The one, the Quell, has been around for a longer period of time and has had, much better uptake. So there are new things. There are new things.
Yeah. And on that topic of new things, as we start to draw to a close, is there any particular new alternative treatment for pain or research that's being done? Anything in particular that you are excited about or keeping an eye on?
Well, one of the things that bothers me a lot is that there's no way to objectively determine the level of a person's pain. So what often happens, a patient says, usually rated from 1 to 10, and often a patient will say, I have a 10 pain. Well, then the physician can't find anything wrong. Well, that doesn't mean the patient's not in pain just because you can't find, the cause at the moment. So I really firmly believe there needs to be developed an objective way to measure pain. Because if there were an objective way to measure pain, it would help physicians know really how severe the pain is, what kind of medication or alternative method they would propose. And it would also reduce the fear that many physicians have that patients are simply drug seeking. And so if they could actually measure what the pain level is, that would relieve that. It would relieve the distrust that often exists between the physician and the patient.
Is there interesting work being done to that end?
Well, early work. Not a lot. The big research area now in neuroscience is all focused on the brain. And so there's lots of studies going on in the brain in terms of, what different regions are involved and whatever. If there are some, what they call neurological pain signatures that have been identified that light up in the brain when certain types of pain occurs in the patient. So far, there isn't just a single pain signature that doesn't seem to exist. It seems to be dependent upon the type of pain. But it's early in the research. So, if it were possible to come up with a way to objectively measure the pain, much like an EKG or, something like that, that gives it some level of confidence that this is a problem. That, I think, would be a huge step forward. But how soon? I don't know. I don't know.
In the meantime, we have resources like the book Pain. Why Do We Continue to Suffer? The Culture and Science of Pain, Connie's book. It's now available on Amazon. Is there anywhere else that people should go to take a look for the book, Connie?
Barnes & Noble, Outskirts Press. It's being distributed to some other local bookstores around.
Pain. Why Do We Continue to Suffer? The Culture and Science of Pain. Connie, thank you for taking some time to talk through your work with us, and best of luck with getting the book and the work out into the world.
Okay, thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you again, Connie, for coming on the Bloodstream podcast, Pain, Why Do We Continue to Suffer? The Culture and Science of Pain by Connie R. Faltynek, Faltynek, is now available at the places that we just mentioned. You can also click the link in the program notes that'll take you directly to the book. Thanks again to Takeda for making the Bloodstream podcast possible, bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about them and their response to COVID-19, bloodstreammedia.com to learn more about all of the podcasts Bloodstream Media makes available, including the Pain Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast wherever you listen. If you've done that, you can leave us a review. And if you've done that too, thanks a lot. You're a superstar. Please share the Bloodstream Podcast with a friend. Word of mouth is the best way that we can reach new people. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.